with more structural solutions for these problems. We tried doing that also in Somalia, where we connected many different local radio stations, solving their problems jointly instead of helping one of those radio stations and then creating false competition. So our model is that we try to help people to make informed decisions and thus have very active influence on the way they are governed and they're governing themselves. We often use media for that now, but we increasingly see, and we'll talk about that, that journalism is broken at the moment. There are serious problems with that. So there might be ways in which we can cut out the middleman and have more direct ways in which people can hold people accountable and be more active in politics. So when we talk about holding powerful people accountable and democratic processes, election reporting is very important. But when you look at how that often happens, is that journalists interview leaders of political parties, see what promises they make, and broadcast that to the people. What then happens is that everyone is interviewing the same politicians, and a lot of information about what were the impact of previous policies, and what are the views of people that are impacted by these policies, is often left out. And this model is also not really good in reporting of more mass movements in which there are not traditionally organized leaders and spokespersons for movements. So media really have a problem grappling with these movements and proper reporting on it. And then media has another huge problem where you're probably aware of it. So I would like you to really look at this and understand what it is. This is the joint income of US newspapers. So the level of income of advertisement revenue has dropped to the level of the 1950s, whereas media outlets are now also expected to come up with much more content. Newspapers are thicker, there is more content in there, but they also need stuff on their websites, often a video stream. And if we look at what's there to make up for it in online revenue, that is such a small part of it. So how does this impact journalism? I want you to think about how it is to be a journalist now. You're sitting at your desk in the morning, and you know that you have to churn out at least 6 items before the end of the day. Whereas you might have great ambitions to do investigative reporting, go out, create stories, search for stories, you have this pressure of putting it out, because else you don't have enough stories for your readers, you will not attract the advertisers, and you will go out of business. So people are taking over a lot of stories that are fed to them by others. So an example of this was the Millennium Bug that most of you probably will remember. It was, so there was supposed to be an apocalypse at the midnight of December 31st, 1999. Power stations were going to be buzzed. There would be no food, no water, nothing so ever. And a lot of money was invested to work on this so-called bug. Why? Because experts told us so. But when you look at the research done on this, where the experts that were telling us about this were also exactly the people that were offering the services to repair these bugs. So there was a vested interest for them. So let's go back to our journalists. Where does the journalist that sits at his or her desk get his or her information from? What do you think? From newspapers, what more? Newswires, indeed. So, and where do the newswires get their information from? From newswires think they have a different role than media outlets, for they see themselves as big aggregators of news. So they don't invest as much time in checking and double checking. They think that's a role of the media. But the media, remember this guy sitting here, I have to churn out six stories by the end of the day. They don't have the time to do that. So if you then get this completely this press release with some scientific research attached to it, with some snappy quotes in there, and some telephone numbers of experts with some quotes and people you can call, that's an easy story. That's an easy way to write your story. So by this way, agenda setting is done by people that are providing content to these people. So this creates a rather problematic view of journalism, even though this is not a thing journalists want, but it's the economic reality they are currently living in. So what are they doing to keep their head above the water? Kind of selling out your user data, because they need the money. They do that by having ads on the websites, and the ads are getting your trackers, cookies, GeoIP data, and selling that through these huge advertising ecosystem. And it is a very and increasingly complicated field, whereas we might think that almost everything goes to Google, and we can hold a very big organization like Google accountable. But what about all these organizations that we, most of us, have never heard of? And what happens when we see those advertisements is that in a very short amount of time, the information is harvested from our computers. It's offered on these ad exchanges to different partners. People, there are automatic bidding processes on your identity. And then at least 70 people have had that information around about you and bid on you. And look what that brings us. Only this. So that is a problem. How are we going to fix it? Because we need to fix it, because we need information to base our opinions, policies, etc. upon, right? So we could say public service broadcasting, have governments fund independent media. But yeah, there are also some problems with that, especially if you think that regimes are repressive, or even in fragile states where there might be no regime to fund these. And of course, with funding, there also come strings attached. So what are then alternatives? Let's look at the citizen media movements and how they evolved. They played a very large role in the Arab Spring, in Tunisia, in Egypt, but recently also again at Gezi Park. So how did we get here? So in the 1990s, the start of the internet, people started to come online. In 2000, people started to use mobile phones and social networking. And right now, people are finding that they can use these platforms also for politics, issue politics, blogging, giving out opinions. And this is creating quite a big change. And let's think about how different that is from technologies that are already there, such as the printing press. Well, every age has its own technologies that provide access to information. Like if the printing press was very important in the French Revolution. Radio was very important in Second World War, but also later on during the Cold War. And when radio was invented back in the 1920s, Bertolt Brecht, a German playwright, said about radio that the full potential of radio can only be realized if the listener is able to talk back. Well, right now, that is the time. People are able to talk back, but we need to find a modus and a language in which we can do that. And in that, storytelling is super important. Because if we just throw data online without context, it's very difficult for people to get to understand what's going on. So just throwing videos of human rights abuses, of shellings, is not enough for people to understand the complete situation. So how can we make these reports better. And then there's the question, can people that make this, that produce this content, really take up the role as a journalist? Because they have a vested interest, right? So the classic journalist there's the concept that he is both an idealist, but is also skeptical, and thus has this critical stance. But can the info activist have such a stance? Well, let's look at that. The concept of a journalist being critical and thus getting a relatively objective representation of the situation is a problematic one. Because then you get into the discussion, what is actually going on? And hasn't the journalist has opinion about things himself? And with the cut budgets, we see, especially in foreign news reporting, there might be one correspondent focusing on whole of Africa or on five countries at the same time, where he or she might not even speak the local language. So if we get more perspectives on a story, then we might come closer to actually having an intersubjective concept of truth instead of trying to come up with an objective one that was problematic from the start. So then if you get continuous views from different people on stories, then news becomes more of a process, a conversation, and a part of the public debate instead of a news piece that's the end of the road. It's someone telling about how a situation actually is. And thus, getting more perspectives probably get a better sense of what is going on. And citizens are functioning as sensors in that. So then we don't have centralized points of control of dissemination of information, not even decentralized with many very diversified media landscape, but no, we have a distributed form of information provision. So if then one note gets taken down because of censorship or of arrest or of intimidation or of propaganda, there are always all these other perspectives that help us fill in the blanks, which is much harder in the other cases. So we are all becoming then producers and consumers of news. So people have many different roles in the news and information environment that's becoming okay. So in these new engagement forms, there is citizen journalism, but also there is far more co-creation and network platforms of public deliberation to come to terms and to have multiple input on cases that people care about. So this is completely rewiring the information environment and also the political environment, potentially. But we haven't completely figured it out yet. So one example of how citizen reporting in Tunisia really had a very big influence on events going on there was this one guy sitting behind his computer and worrying about expenses of the president. And he thought, looking at that, a symbol could be the presidential airplane. So he started looking at air spotters, plane spotters website, where the presidential airplane of Tunisia was spotted. And he found out it happened in all these different capitals of the Western world. And then when he compared it to what was known of official travels of the president, there were only two there, and there were more than 25 travels made. Then by plotting this in such a flyover in Google Earth, he asked the question in his blog, what happens? Where is this plane going to? And then pictures started popping up of the wife of the president going on a shopping spree in all these different capitals of the world. This really changed the conception of power and privilege. And when then, just before on January 23, the things in Tunisia started. So how do you know, how did the situation in Tunisia? What happened? Yeah, do we remember the name of this guy? Sidi Bouzid. So Sidi Bouzid was living in a small town in Tunisia and had a grocery store and just was educated but wasn't able to pay the bills anymore. He didn't see any way more out. So this infuriated huge demonstrations. But a grocery shopper not being able to pay the bills and take care of his family and then committing suicide is unfortunately not an exceptional case in many countries. But 2 weeks before that, TuniLeaks, which was more or less at the same time as WikiLeaks, brought out the cables that the Ben Ali government was no longer supported militarily or politically by the US government, which gave the people enough trust and to see that if they would take the risk of going out on the street and showing their fury, that they would not be suppressed by forces supported by the US government. Ben Ali would be on his own. So this gave people an idea, wow, maybe we have a chance. And the rest is history. So this is how leaking and information is turning journalism and information completely upside down. So, but at the same time, these technologies, took this in Egypt, it's part of a bigger artwork. They are liberating us. But at the same time, and that's what I like about this picture, you can also see like, maybe they're also putting us on other chains. So whereas we really like the opportunities that we have with mobile and capturing and distributing things, also a lot of risks are there. So you all know about phone tracking, GPS, phone towers. Yeah, you can go to a lot of talks about SIM card exploitation here. I won't go through that here. But we still use those phones even though we know it. And these people, yeah, they definitely know that as well. But then there are also other even more problematic security vulnerabilities in phones. And we don't only use phones as phones anymore, we also use smartphones where there are our photos, email, browsing, etc., etc. And governments or third-party actors could get access to these people that are then posting all this critical content and information out there. And if all these people, if these info activists become kind of journalists, then also a very important trait of journalism comes into play, and that is source protection. Well, how can we do source protection if we were working on such a problematic platform? Difficult. So, and then there's also, of course, the GSM eavesdropping, and there are many risks involved, but it's not magic. So if we try to understand what's going on and make proper threat models of our adversaries, their capabilities, the probability that they're after you and their resources and time, then you get up to a likelihood in a threat model about how you can counter that. So that's the thing that this led us to come up with this thing called Storymaker. Storymaker is an... the actual moment that I can say this is when we started thinking about it was when we were thinking about how can we train bloggers and citizen reporters. Classically, if we train media outlets, we go to a radio station, TV station, or a newspaper. After a deadline, we sit all the journalists down, and we're going to do a training on media management, on reporting, on editing, on business models, etc. But getting a lot of bloggers in a potentially dangerous situation together in one room might cause problems for their safety and security. But I don't know if you ever put a lot of bloggers in one room and then it might cause some problems because these people are used to all having their own opinion and not working in a group. So group trainings for these people might not be secure and might not be very effective. So how can we actually reach these people and also give them information in a way that they like it? So we thought maybe we go to the devices and the places they use. So that's when we were starting about thinking about making a curriculum on digital security and journalism on a mobile phone. But I made manuals before, and probably you also all made some manuals or how-tos or documentation of packages. And what's the problem? People do not really read them. So how can you convince people or help people remember that? It's the same with MOOCs, right? How many people of you have started doing a MOOC, an online course? How many of you finished that course? Okay, I think the percentage is pretty good here, because overall that's 3% of people finishing MOOCs. We start off with these great ideas, and then we get the first week's homework. Well, maybe we do that, and then you get the second week's, and then there's Twitter and some series to watch and email boxes to empty, and we don't finish it. So how are we going to counter that? Well, by trying to integrate that curriculum and learning in the daily workflow of the citizen reporter. So we wanted to add something that they would use every day. So not something that would be an obnoxious widget that comes up every time, like, have you done your lesson today? Because then people would find out ways to just throw it away and start hating us. So how can we have something that really helps people and then also enables them to learn about these things? So that's when we came up with an editor and publishing suite. Because as said before, in Ethiopia and Afghanistan, it is such a problem. If you need to get laptops for everyone, a recorder. If you want to do video, then you also have to have a video camera, maybe even light. You have to have batteries. You have to make sure that it keeps on working. So this is actually really expensive, especially if you want to do it for individuals, right? But a mobile phone can enable us to do all of those things at the same time. So if we can help people capture, edit on their phone, and then publish anonymously to a third-party platform that they like, yeah, that might be a tool that they would use. And then we could integrate that with the curriculum, and yeah, let's see where it goes. So the way we're going to do that, the only thing we can do that is by doing it open source and completely licensed under Creative Commons. Because journalism is broken. Citizen media is an alternative, but it's definitely not there yet. So if we want to improve it, we got to work with it, with many different people on it. And that's why we're enabling many people to edit it and alter it for their own situation. And of course, there are the issue trackers and the bug trackers, but we also made it easier for people. So we're organizing there is a weekly video scrum where everyone can join on, users. There's a support email address, but people can also go to the wiki, and in the app there is also a feature request and bug reports. So because we do not think we can do it alone, we got some of the people together that we thought could really help us make this a success. So we got funding from the Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs and RFA. And then we sat together with the International Center for Journalists, Small World News, and the Guardian Project to make this happen. But designing something without involving the user, that's like a project to fail. So then we involved Global Voices, the world's biggest blogger network, and journalism training organizations in Tunisia, Morocco, Iraq, and Egypt to help with us come up with the user stories. What do you need, and how do we get the users to get them what they actually want and involve them in testing? So what we're doing right now is, with this version of the app, training 600 people in these different countries. And we're doing that not because we think that people need training next to the app, but it's to understand how people are using the app and what are the levels of satisfaction, and is their content actually getting better. So every country has their own training approach on how to implement it. And they also all have different selection criteria for groups that they want to involve. Some people strongly have groups of 50-50 professional journalists and citizen journalists. Some people do it in urban centers. In Egypt, they go completely to Upper Egypt. because they look from the Nile up. That's why they call it Upper Egypt. And they work with rural communities because everyone and their brother in Cairo have already been trained on citizen media and digital security. And it's not really effective. So we're with this, we're trying to see what groups are most susceptible for this, how can they use it, and how can we make it better. So we're not really only training in those countries. We're also doing it in Zimbabwe and Libya, and we now also got a translation into Russian. But this is part of the improvement and testing track. So other people are really very welcome to use it as well, but this is how we try to keep track of how we can improve it. So let me do a quick run through of the app. So if you open the app, you have the two parts, the storytelling part, and the lessons. So let's just click here and explore some lessons. There are lessons on journalism, security, audio, photo, and video. And if we go into a lesson, you see all these smaller cut up pieces of lessons. And the lessons then comprise of an introduction, a problem statement, a background, things to remember, and videos, photos, and audios to strengthen the lesson and give examples. The solution, and then a small quiz on the end of each lesson to test your knowledge. And if things are unclear, there's a pretty big glossary that also links back and refers to lessons and to Wikipedia. So once you complete lessons, this goes back into your central screen. So then the real meat of the app, the editor. So when you make a story, you click on New, and you're given a working title, and you select if you want to work on video, photo, audio, or a photo essay, and you select what template you kind of you want to work with. There are simple stories, and there are more complex templates. So you think, why are we doing templates? Isn't that making it less original, or are we trying to push people in a mold? Maybe so. Because when you teach people journalism, for doesn't matter for how long or where, the first time you give them a device and they go out, they will go up to someone and they will just ask, what do you think about this subject? And this person will start talking for about 20 minutes. And it's impossible to make an interesting item out of that. So we want people to actually already start editing before they start recording. So think of a subject, but also an angle and how to make it relevant. Think of your audience, think of different questions. So we're with these templates, we're trying to help people conceptualize the item that they want to make. So when you then start capturing, we're giving people advice on what you can capture about a character with some questions with it. And except from only doing that content-wise, we're also trying to do that visually. Because you all know the standard wide screen shot about something happening far away that's vibrating kind of bit. And it is not fun to watch. So if we teach people about the rules of thirds, and using better perspectives, items can become far more fun to watch. So that's why there are also small templates in the screen so people get ideas on how to frame their pictures better. So, and thus you're going to the second capture and show the character engaged in his or her environment. And you see there we have a different overlay to show and give ideas about how you can do that. So once you have done that with sufficient clips, as many as you like, we're going to the order part, where we can here put the clips we've shot in different orders, but we can also click on trim clip. And what we then do is select the part of the video we want, press trim, and there we cut the item. So if you want several parts from the item, then you can add the clip again, and you use, for instance, only the beginning and only the end. And when you're then done, you can record a voiceover over the whole story. And then you're given a title, a description, a tag, a location that you can also grab from your GPS. You can export it, play it, share it on via the services you have on your phone, or publish it to YouTube, Vimeo, Flickr, or any third-party platform you like. And a standard setting is that you also cross-publish it to the Storymaker site, where we do not have the content, but a link to it. And if you then live in Egypt, Morocco, Tunisia, or Iraq, within 48 hours, you get a reaction on how you might improve your a piece of content from the people from Global Voices and the training centers. So this was a rough overview of the app. So I really invite you to download it, play with it, and tell us how we can improve it. It is in the Android Play Store, and it is only on Android for several reasons. We did quite a lot to integrate security, encryption, uploading over Tor, uploading over VPN, and we were not able to do this on other platforms. So open source is very important for us. So that's why we've been focusing on Android. But a maybe even more pressing argument is that it's simply the cheapest phones that are able to do this, that are on the market in the countries that we work. So the price point for a phone that where Storymaker can work on acceptably is about $200. So that's what we said, as that's the maximum that a phone should cost for it to be in the hands of the people we want to work with. So, and this is a big QR code. You can scan it and you go directly to the Google Store, if you trust me. So, great questions. Those were 64 slides in less than 40 minutes. That was great, no? Oh, yeah.
Question, is this, how can I make this so that it doesn't appear on the people reporting's phone? Should I fork it, or, I mean, I work a lot with people in Bangladesh, which has an evil government, and they actually check their employees' phone before people go into factories, and if there's like a suspicious app, that could be troublesome. So if this would be like, show us your kitten pictures, that would be so much better than saying like, I'm doing a critical documentary app. So is there any way we could sort of like hide it from not like full scale NSA surveillance, but from like local thugs, police, crap?
Yes. let me give also a slightly longer answer. For now, we had a short version freeze, because what we saw is that users, even though we tell them this is beta, we want to test this with you, they really, really, really get demotivated with bugs. And users really do not like to file bug reports. So that's why right now, we were focusing on really ironing out all the bugs and getting it used, getting it to work on all these different Android devices, because there are also so many around, right? And then there are a lot of different ideas of enhancing things. So we already broke our rule of the version freeze and integrated Obscura Cam in the app. So it's very easy to obscure faces of people in photos or in videos. This might be come in handy when, for instance, at a demonstration, there is you want to depict a policeman or someone else hitting someone, but you don't want the person who are standing next to it or being hit for revealing their identity. So we can do that in photo and video right now. We're also doing better encryption of the content that's being shot, so that it doesn't go to your gallery, but it's kept in an encrypted container with IO cipher. So that is almost done now. The next step is indeed also changing the icon. But on most in Android ICS, you can already change the icons of the app. So we are still thinking, should we use this as a, should we just build this in as a feature, or should we put it in the curriculum to ask to tell people how to change it? And actually, there have hardly been people been arrested for having specific apps on their phone. Great, maybe you can point me to those resources, that would be good. And then one more point that is also pretty exciting that I forgot to tell. So we have a €1,000 reward for the best bug report or feature request. So if you come up with this feature and you think they're useful, file them in the wiki or send an email to support@storymaker.tc and you make the project and yourself better.
Yeah, I was thinking you could hide it as a game. So you start playing the game, you do something, and then you...
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, so you can choose any icon as it is now. You can choose any icon that are in stock Android right now.
Not the icon. If you actually click the icon, it will start up some game, and you have to make a specific action to start up the app.
Possible, but what we actually did now the opposite is that make a quick start widget, so that people can click directly and go directly to capture, because that is actually something that people feel that is more needed instead of going through all these steps before starting up their project. They want quick capture.
A question: is it possible to store like the report you're making locally but encrypted on an, for instance, a micro SD card? Because we also work a lot in Burma, and basically what we're using is SneakerNet. People walk across the border with SD cards hidden in various interesting places, and they only get uploaded once they reach Thailand. So is it because you cannot upload from Burma at the moment. So is it possible to store it locally but have it encrypted and then take out the SD card, have that SD card transported by somebody to another place and only then publish it?
Exports locally done. So in the next version there is also then IO cipher integrated, and then you can also choose it to have it encrypted. SneakerNets. So if you press share, it will give you it will allow you to share it with any of the protocols that you have working on Android. So you can do it via Wi-Fi direct or Bluetooth or but even if you would have a mesh network, for instance, going on or something like that, that's possible as well. So it integrates with those options as well.
Okay, one more question here in the back.
Hi, Niels. Thank you for the talk. I think it's an interesting, great tool. You mentioned the list of countries deploying where you're deploying the tool. I noticed that Syria was not on the list. Maybe if you can explain if you have intentions for that country. And also, because you mentioned briefly that story making is not so, like, it also has to do with making a complete journalistic product, right? So maybe you can briefly comment on if that's lacking now in the few footage we get from Syria.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's a great question. So no, we're not deploying it in all countries where such a tool would be needed. We're not doing it in Iran. We're not doing it in Syria. Why not? Because this is beta. And we cannot really ask from people under these harsh conditions to test with us and file bug reports, right? So we want to have a product that is safe and secure and field tested before we deploy it in circumstances where it might have very dire consequences to use such a thing. Content coming out of Syria is very important. right now for understanding for us what's going on, because there are hardly any foreign journalists in Syria, especially not after foreign journalists have been killed there. So we really rely on local reporting. But this local reporting is, it's only embedded in mainstream media within someone else, an expert talking about it. So we don't really get the complete perspectives from the people on the ground. So if we would help them come up with these templates and frame it, give us more information to verify what's going on, then it would be far easier for people to consume that directly and not having it go through the filter of mainstream media through which they might not have access, right? So in especially in Morocco and Zimbabwe, what we find also really important is that citizen media content may be everywhere around us, but in countries where internet penetration is really low, it's a relatively small discussion. So, and where the traditional media have far more reach, we think it's also really important that the citizen reporting content also penetrates the mainstream media. But for this, we do not only need to fix things content-wise, we also need to work on trust and communication between journalists and traditional media outlets. So that's why we're in the trainings working with traditional media professional journalists and citizen journalists to have them understand their problems and issues. But we're also having assignments for the citizen journalists who are in the training with traditional media. So they get to see to what standards it has to live up for it to live on the website of a traditional media outlet. One further thing that we're most probably going to build is a marketplace for content, so that people can request content, maybe even add a template or people they want interviewed, and show where they want to use it for, and if they want to, if they can compensate people for it. So thus, traditional media outlets or others would have a direct contact to a huge reporter network all over the world of citizen reporters.
Thank you very much. Are there any more questions? Yes, one up here.
Hi. Just to understand well, the identity of the reporter is totally unknown from you two. You don't know who is posting report.
No. So if you download it and upload something, you can do that completely pseudonymously. But yeah, if you're uploading, most people are now uploading to YouTube, so you need a Google account.
In that case, how do you deal with manipulation problems? For example, imagine when you will be in Syria, you have a report with Storymaker showing that the resistance is using chemical weapons made by the government. How do you deal with it? How can you check and how can you deal with the manipulations, eventually manipulation from the from every movement?
Yeah, this is a great question. So,
I think about the video of the resistance of the man eating a heart. It was a true video, but we had to check it. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, verification is super important. So one way to verify is that if you have more sources for the story, that helps. So you can get in contact with this person that posted the video. The person will have posted it under a certain account, and you can leave a content on YouTube or via the Storymaker website, you can post to that account.
You can contact the person.
Yeah.
You can contact it, okay.
But what we're also thinking of integrating is this tool called InformaCam. Some of you have heard about it. So it's this tool to use all the sensors that are on the mobile phone to give their information on the location, the compass, the network time, the towers that were in the vicinity, to allow for far better verification with more means of the photo, video, or piece of audio that has been recorded. That right now is a standalone app from the Guardian project, but as we've done with Obscuracam, we might also be able to integrate it in here. But if we do that, so we want some stuff, we want to be people to be really anonymous, and for some things we want it to be radically verifiable. So if you find such an image that you were there on that place on that time, then it's really connecting you with that place and that. So we need to do more thinking about that, and also far more development of secure InformaCam, because it's not done yet. But this is definitely something we think a lot about.
Okay, if there are no more questions, I think we can leave it at that. Oh, sorry, one more here.
So I was wondering, since you mentioned that you support open source, is this also an open source application?
It's completely open source. It's all on Git. And also the app strings are in TransFX. And we're also putting the whole journalism curriculum also in TransFX. Right now, the languages that is available in completely is English for Southern Africa, English for Northern Africa, English for the rest of the world, and Arabic. So, but we are now having the app strings are translated into Spanish, and next week it will also happen in Russian. So, yeah, if you want to join, yeah, please help us translate.
There's a little typo over there. Story Naker.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would also call, I mean, I only learned about this application for a few days ago, but it is really important that people that are working in nonprofits, we have contacts with people who speak local languages, and if your nonprofit is not contributing on a financial level because they're poor, one way you can contribute it is by making languages available. Because this is civic journalism and it needs to be in local languages, and we need a lot. And TransFX is actually quite easy. I tried today, and the Bengali translation is now at 20%, and it will proceed. And they understood the whole thing.
Wow!
So get
nice. Applaud for that.
Nice. Wow.
Thank you very much, Niels. Awesome Thank presentation. You. Download the app and start breaking it so Niels can improve on it. And big round of applause.